You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM in Fairfield, Iowa, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, grassroots listener-supported solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. It's a beautiful October 2016 day on this live broadcast. And you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It is a beautiful day. And you know what I saw on the way over here? Complete half moon up in the sky at... it was 11:30. I couldn't believe it was. Yeah, it was. It was. It was up there.
Wow.
And yeah, it was amazing. It really was amazing. And it is a beautiful day. And, you know, it could stay like this all winter. I'd be
were
fine.
Were you the one just telling me about why they call it the harvest moon?
Yes, I did read that because it was full for 3 nights. And so that's why they called it harvest.
Because the farmers could harvest in the moonlight.
Uh-huh.
And is it, I mean, usually we think of harvest moon as being very orange, but not necessarily. It just means it's full for 3 nights.
It's orange when it first comes up. If you see it on the horizon, it's orange, but wow. Then it gets white as
Great.
It goes up. Yeah.
Well, Mom, let's tell our listeners about our guests today.
Well, our guests today are the authors, co-authors of Blood Brother, and it's a story of Jonathan Daniels and his sacrifice for the civil rights movement, and Rich Wallace has written more than 36 novels for children and teenagers. His first novel, Wrestling Surbridge, was selected for YALSA as one of the 100 best of the 21st century. Wow.
Wow.
His acclaimed middle grade nonfiction, Babe Conquers the World, is co-written with his wife, Sandra Neal Wallace. And she had a lengthy career as a news anchor and ESPN sportscaster. She became the first woman to host the NHL show on network TV and part of the first ESPN crew to cover WNBA before co-writing Babe Conquers the World and the award-winning fiction titles Muckers and Little Joe. And this book is really something.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Rich and Sandra.
Thanks so much, Monica and Caroline. We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah, thanks to have us on.
Now, is this the second book that you've co-written then, or have there been more in between?
There have been a couple since that aren't out yet, but this
okay.
is the second project that we did together.
Okay.
Definitely the lengthiest project. It took us about 3 years from research to completion of writing the book.
Yeah, speaking of research, I had questions I was going to ask, and I'm still going to ask them. But in the back, it tells exactly how you researched, and that's a marvelous thing about this book. It's a history.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, it was interesting. We moved to Keene, New Hampshire, in 2009, which is the hometown of Jonathan Daniels. We had never heard of this American civil rights hero before, and we immediately found out about him and how he died, but we didn't know how he lived, and initially we thought this was going to be maybe a 100-page biography, and as we delved deeper, and as you can see, it's, what is it, Rich, over 300...
352-page book. We conducted, you know, a couple of dozen interviews of our own and just delved into... really substantial archives starting here at Keene State College, which has a great collection of Jonathan Daniels material.
Well, let's just start with briefly, who was Jonathan Daniels and what did he do? Just a brief, because like you, most of us have never heard of him.
Yeah, well, Jonathan was a New Englander. He was a young man from Keene, New Hampshire. He was a seminarian in 1965 when the event that came to be known as Bloody Sunday occurred in Selma, Alabama, where John Lewis was leading a group that was trying to march from Selma to Montgomery to demonstrate for their voting rights. Dr. King, Martin Luther King, after those people had been beaten severely by state troopers, asked for clergy from the North to come South to help stand with these heroic people. And Jonathan was one of the first people on a plane to get down there and spent the rest of his short life in the Selma area, working for voting rights, and eventually was murdered.
He was really one of the few white civil rights activists who stayed to work with black Americans to protest against racial discrimination in voting. So after answering Dr. King's call to get involved, he felt that it would really be hypocritical to leave after a few days when they found out that the secondary march, which was the march from Selma to Montgomery, was stalling because of some red tape. Most of his colleagues and other white civil rights workers from the North decided to leave, get back to their lives. And Jonathan decided to stay and be embedded for the rest of his short life. 5 months later, he was killed.
Wow. Now, the format of the book is kind of unusual. It's written for young people. I'm guessing middle school age is the main target.
Middle school and teenager, mm-hmm. although it has definitely crossed over into the adult market.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can see why.
And it almost looks like a textbook in terms of the weight and the heft of it. And a little bit, I think, in terms of the graphic layout, too. Is that what you were going for?
Well, we're always complimented when people feel that it looks a lot like a Ken Burns book that would be a companion book to a documentary, but within the book, we have a double narrative going on. So our quote-unquote documentary is really the visual.
Right. Oh, yeah, this book has many pictures.
That was going to be one of my questions. How in the world did you find all those pictures?
Well, Monica and Caroline, it really was detective work. When we, as I mentioned earlier, we didn't know a lot about Jonathan's life. And as we started doing our preliminary research, we spent about 6 months at the Keene State College archives that house his diaries and journals and images. We quickly realized that Jonathan was an amateur photographer, and he took a camera with him to Alabama, and he chronicled his life being embedded as a civil rights activist at that time. And many of those photos were developed from his camera after he was killed. And what was incredible about those photos, there were so many black Americans who were teenagers at the time that he took photos of, but they were unidentified. And we were determined to find them. And we went to Selma, Alabama, several times, and we were able to identify the people in the photos and
wow.
interview them. They had never been interviewed about Jonathan Daniels, and a lot of them had never been interviewed, period, about their freedom fighting days and how they protested nonviolently for the right to vote. And that really deepened our understanding of Jonathan's activism. And it was amazing to be able to connect with them and to find dozens of people who were so young at the time. We felt that a narrative that's been missing about the civil rights movement are the teenagers and college students like Jonathan who put their schooling on hold to demonstrate for the right to vote.
Yeah, Jonathan wasn't much older than them. And again, as Sandra said, one of the surprises to us was how important it was that these high school students were protesting really for their parents' right to vote. They couldn't. They were 15, 16, 17 years old
mm-hmm.
time, and they were leaving school. They were standing on the protest lines. Jonathan got to know them very well. He kind of looked up to him as a leader because he was in his mid-20s at the time, but he really wasn't much older than they were.
Well, you know, it was dangerous to be there.
Dangerous for all of them who were working
right.
toward that.
Right.
And you know, Jonathan was a seminarian, and he did wear his seminarian collar most of the time that he was working in the Deep South. And that kind of made him a target as well, because he was viewed very much as an outsider by the segregationists in Alabama. He stood out.
And at that time, churches in Alabama were segregated, including Jonathan's own denomination, which was the Episcopal Church. So you can imagine him protesting, being in front of the protest lines during the week, Monday through Saturday, and on Sunday insisting on wearing his seminarian collar and integrating the Episcopal Church in Selma, Alabama, with his black colleagues, and basically forcing the segregationists who were in the pews several rows before him to really look at segregation as a moral issue, and he represented everything that they were against, and he threatened their way of life.
Now, did he have the support of the Episcopalian leadership?
Well, he was an nationally? Episcopal divinity student at the time, so he had the support of the Episcopal Theological School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he had been a student. Mm. He also had the support of ESCRU, which is the Episcopal Society for Cultural and Racial Unity, which was based in Atlanta and was certainly supporting his efforts. He definitely did not have the support of the powers that be in the Episcopal Church in Alabama.
Right, but nationally, was there a divide in the Episcopalian Church between?
Definitely was. It was against canon law to segregate the Episcopal Church, but of course we know that never stopped segregationists, as well as in education and in religion, from not continuing to condone and practice segregation. So there absolutely was a divide. And Jonathan was known, just as Dr. King was known, and John Lewis, who was also a preacher, they were known as outside agitators. Mm. And really, they were thought of as people who came in and were really not, should have minded their own business and not come in and fought nonviolently to end racial discrimination and segregation.
Yes, because if they the powers that be there, they just wanted it like it always been. They didn't want any change.
Very much so. Yes.
Yeah.
What amazed me was, after the federal law was passed, they still didn't. They didn't comply.
Well, we're seeing that. We're still seeing that today. I don't. Are you, Sandra and Rich? Are you familiar with Ari Berman? So he's from Fairfield, where we live here. He grew up here, and we've had him on Writer's Voices in the past, and hope to get him on with his new show, which is, or his new book, which is, I think, Give Me the Ballot.
Was out last year, and he is familiar with our book. And obviously, our book is so timely. You know, Jonathan was killed exactly 2 weeks after the Voting Rights Act, and one of the incredible research treasure troves that we came across was a private collection that included a diary by a Jewish leader named Rabbi Harold Saperstein, who worked with Jonathan the week before Jonathan was jailed. And Rabbi Saperstein chronicled every day what they did in Lowndes County, which was considered one of the most dangerous counties in America, Bloody Lowndes. Jonathan became the first white civil rights worker to work alongside the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to register black voters. And when Jonathan arrived in Alabama in March of 1965, zero African Americans in Lowndes County ever cast a ballot in the 20th century and were not registered to vote. By the time Jonathan was jailed in the middle of August of 1965, he had assisted in registering 1,000 black Americans. Lowndes County was 80% black. So the struggle and the danger was very real. You probably know of the fact that for a black American to be able to register to vote in Alabama at that time, first of all, they had to go to the courthouse, and they were met by a billy club-wielding sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
If they got into the courthouse, they were required to take what was called a literacy test, which meant that they had to know every part of the U.S. Constitution, every part of the Alabama Constitution. And then the final questions were unanswerable questions like, how much water is in the Alabama River?
When all that
was finished, if they had a white employer, many of them, if they would find out that one of their black employees had attempted to register to vote, they would fire that employee. So that's what they were dealing with and what Jonathan was dealing with in 1965 in Selma and in areas of Alabama.
Now, obviously, they weren't giving that same test to the whites who are trying to vote. How did they justify not having everybody have to pass the same test?
Was stopping them, you know, until the Voting Rights
Act.
Act was passed in mid-August of 65 when the feds finally did come in and start enforcing the laws. They just got away with anything they wanted.
I want to correct what I said. The title of Ari's book, Ari Berman's book, is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And the point that in that book is that it hasn't ended. And there are states today that are breaking the law and trying to repress votes still.
The Supreme Court allowed the Voting Rights Act to be eviscerated a bit over the last several years, and many states have taken advantage of that and put up voter ID laws and taken away Sunday voting and all kinds of restrictions that simply are designed to suppress the minority vote.
When you really think about it, our constitutional right to vote should be effortless and easy, and really it's not. And it continues to be bewildering why we have so many impediments for us to be able to vote freely. And that was something that Jonathan felt so strongly about, and he was willing to stand by his convictions and risk his life for it, for all of us to be able to vote freely.
But what's
it was
amazing.
Not easy at all for people like Ruby Sales and Stokely Carmichael and Jonathan Daniels to go from farm to farm in Lowndes County trying to convince sharecroppers to register to vote or to attempt to register to vote. They were being followed by Klansmen and members of the White Citizens Council and chased and harassed constantly, and their lives were always in danger.
Okay, did they tutor some of these people? Because I wouldn't know what the Iowa Constitution says. I mean, how would they?
There were. They would pass around really interesting, helpful literature, a number of different things. They actually passed around comic books. There were citizenship classes. Jonathan didn't necessarily wasn't involved in that. He was involved in canvassing and really convincing them, once they saw that the danger that he faced, convincing them and, you know, civil disobedience, really getting the media involved in taking photographs and images of what was happening to black Americans who tried to register to vote. For instance, in Lowndes County, they didn't go to the county courthouse. They were made to go to the town jail to register as a form of intimidation.
Yeah.
And Jonathan, who was a representative of ESCRU, working alongside of SNCC, who was a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, did end up filing, you know, getting the Department of Justice involved and federal registrars, so that before the Voting Rights Act actually passed, registrars in Lowndes County and in Selma, Alabama, knew that they were being watched and monitored, and slowly, temporarily dropped the literacy tests because they were hoping that the federal registrars wouldn't come and that they could eventually go back to their corrupt ways.
Mm.
Or 2 days after the Voting Rights Act was passed, federal registrars were in Lowndes County and Selma, Alabama, and registering blacks, where at that point all they had to do was sign their name and register to vote.
Mm. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today.
Jonathan's life, because a few days after that, where there was a huge amount of tension, in a small town of Fort Deposit, Alabama, a group of teenagers decided that they would peacefully protest in front of some stores on their main street where they'd been either treated badly or charged higher prices or not even allowed in. And Jonathan and Stokely Carmichael and several others participated in that demonstration, which barely got started before they were all arrested. So Jonathan and a group of about 20 mostly black teenagers were arrested, hauled off to the Hainville jail about 20 miles away. They were actually transported in a garbage truck.
Yeah.
Were jailed on trumped-up charges and spent the next 6 days and nights in that jail in very horrible conditions. And I thought maybe I would take this opportunity to read a little bit from the beginning of the book where we describe the conditions in that jail and what that was like.
Okay,
sure.
That'd be good.
This is Rich Wallace reading from Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights.
Okay. Haynesville, Alabama, August 20th, 1965. It was their sixth day in hell, otherwise known as the Haynesville Jail. Toilets overflowed. Plates of greasy beans rotted on the floor, and the sheriff refused to take any of it away. The food is vile, and we aren't allowed to bathe, wrote Jonathan Myrick Daniels, dripping with sweat in the hottest week of the summer. There were no fans. Filthy mattresses covered the steel bunks. The water supply to the sinks was frequently shut off. Yet the jailed protesters were singing. Crammed into four steaming cells, the 20 young people, all but two of them black and most of them teenagers, sang hopeful freedom songs and hymns. Jonathan sang loud and clear, working hard to raise the spirits of his fellow prisoners. The singing was strong enough to be heard three blocks away, increasing the tension in an already riled-up Alabama town. Jonathan was afraid, but he tried to hide it. He'd been warned not to get involved in the protest that landed the group in jail, a peaceful demonstration to call attention to the unfair treatment of black residents at local stores. They kill people for things like this, a priest told him. They're looking for people like you. People like you meant men and women, white men and women, who joined the civil rights movement to help bring about the constitutional freedoms that black people were being denied. In the eyes of many Southerners, the only person lower than an African American was any white Northerner who came to the South to support the movement. In that summer of 1965, segregationists viewed Jonathan, a 26-year-old white seminary student from New Hampshire, as a traitor to his own race. Suddenly, the singing stopped. A jailer pulled out his keys and unlocked the cells. You're free to go, he told the prisoners. Sidestepping hundreds of paper plates piled high in the hallway, reeking of rotting food, the prisoners walked out of jail. But as their eyes adjusted to the sunlight, a wave of fear and suspicion eclipsed their relief. They hadn't been bailed out. Jonathan's friend Stokely Carmichael, a leader of the civil rights organization that was working to raise bail money, was nowhere in sight. It didn't feel right, said Ruby Sales. The teenager was convinced that the hasty release was a setup. He couldn't help thinking about the civil rights workers murdered in Mississippi the summer before. Those three men had been released from jail unexpectedly, too, then shot to death in the middle of the night. But what could happen in broad daylight on a busy Friday afternoon in Haynesville's town square? Yet it was eerily quiet, the streets deserted. Deciding that the horrific jail conditions felt safer than walking through Haynesville, Jonathan and the group pleaded to stay on jail property. A deputy sheriff forced them onto the street. Something bad was about to happen. Ruby felt sure of it. We were let out of jail specifically for someone to be killed.
Wow. Oh, that's Rich Wallace reading from Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights. So, Rich and Sandra, what was there? Was there anything in Jonathan's youth or background that would have predicted that he would devote his life to this?
Absolutely, everything he had done in his life, even from the time he was a young age. We started interviewing people in Keene after when we got the idea for this book. Because there are many people here in town who went to school with Jonathan, who befriended him, knew him throughout his entire life. He would be 77 years old now, so many of his contemporaries are still around. I thought maybe I'd continue to read just a little bit. Following that excerpt that I just read, we go into Jonathan's childhood in the book.
Sure.
And so it might be pertinent if I read a couple of pages from the opening chapter.
Good idea.
Obviously, that last moment I just read about ended is that Jonathan was murdered. So, and that was what was known about Jonathan Daniels. Where he was known nationally, it was that he had taken a bullet by stepping in front of a teenage colleague who happened to be Ruby Sales. They walked about a half a block after being released from jail to a small grocery store where they had been treated well in the past. And as they walked up the steps to the store, a deputy sheriff stepped out, drew his gun, aimed at Ruby, and Jonathan instinctively pushed her aside and took the bullet, and that was the end of his life. So again, we knew how he had died. We wanted this book to examine how he had lived.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just read the beginning of what is really the opening chapter after that introduction that I read a moment ago. So born March 20th, 1939, the first of 9,651 days. Jonathan Daniels was a rebel, but he was also a deep thinker. As a kid in Keene, New Hampshire, he had a way of discovering secret places where he could sneak away to daydream. Like that crawl space under his family's house on Summer Street. When he removed the loose bricks from a wall in the basement and grabbed hold of an overhead pipe, Jonathan could swing his feet up and make his way into the space under the dining room. It was cool and dark and smelled like dirt, the perfect meeting place for his friends. First, it took some work. Jonathan and his friend Bob Perry spent weeks carting out dirt to enlarge the area. Got on our hands and knees and dug out a bigger space, Bob recalled. Eventually, it was 8 feet wide and long. They brought in a few old chairs and made a bench with a board and some concrete blocks, but they could dig only at certain times. We had to do it when his mother wouldn't be aware, Bob said. Jonathan's friends knew that he had strict rules to live by. As the son of the town's busiest doctor and a status-conscious mother, he was expected to never bend those rules. Use your best manners at dinner and choose the right silverware. Do your homework and your chores. Always be on time. Keeping track of time was easy in downtown Keene back in the 1940s and 50s. Train whistles blared at regular intervals, and the congregational church bell chimed on the hour in the town square. The difficult part was sneaking around those rules. Clever and resourceful, Jonathan discovered how. By the time he reached junior high school in 1951, 12-year-old Jonathan Daniels was a firebrand. He'd been sweet and loving and affectionate and obedient, said his mother. Suddenly, he became argumentative and rebellious and defiant and sneaky. Mm-hmm. Because Jonathan was constantly grounded, his time with his friends was cut short. Jonathan was also a bit of a ham. He earned major roles in shows put on by the Keene Children's Theater and performed in the school and church choirs and the band. He loved to escape into books, which he said unlocked a great door to magnificent adventure. The stories that struck him most told about rescues from great danger. The exciting tales of valiant knights and fair ladies, Jonathan wrote. Thin, klutzy Jonathan dreamed beautiful, fantastic dreams of myself as a great hero. He liked to hunker down in the crawl space and light up a camel cigarette, which he kept hidden in an old Band-Aid tin, and listen as his friends described the elaborate ceremonies of their churches. On Sundays, Jonathan, his parents, and his younger sister Emily attended Keene's First Congregational Church, but he found the services too plain and boring. Congregationalists don't kneel and you don't chant and you don't have vestments and all that sort of thing, a friend observed. So Jonathan made his own church. He built an altar in the crawl space and preached sermons to his friends, burning incense and sipping wine he'd swiped from his parents.
Oh.
He started out in life as a saint, but he always was driven by his faith. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the interesting things by him. And he was also always driven by doing the right thing and looking out for justice, even if it was just a kid being bullied. Jonathan was always sticking up for the other kid.
Now, when you started writing this, did he have any family members that were still living?
No.
Unfortunately not. Jonathan had a younger sister, Emily, who died just while we were starting our research. And his mother and father, of course, were deceased. His father ended up, who was a doctor, died when Jonathan was a junior at the Virginia Military Institute. So we weren't able to personally interview family members. They had been interviewed, and there were transcripts that we were able to access. And I want to just continue with one thing that Richard said. Keene did not have racial barriers, but there were definitely ethnic and class barriers, and Jonathan was able to break through those. There was an Italian section, and there was an Irish section, and then he was considered, because he was the son of the doctor, being a family of social status and of a mother who enjoyed being a socialite, and Jonathan saw through that and saw the hypocrisies, because if you went into the Daniels' house, it was a disaster. It was messy. Mrs. Daniels was a pack rat. So he saw the hypocrisies, and also his father was so good-natured. He was a well regarded doctor, and he would rarely take money for his services. He wouldn't say no to any call, and if someone couldn't pay the bill, that was just fine by him. So the family was broke, and he just enjoyed a person and getting through to who they were, human to human. So he had friends that he enjoyed having pizza on torn couches, and he also had friends that were living in mansions in Keene.
Well, his father was really, I would say, a local hero, wasn't he, because of the things that he did?
He was very, very well regarded. And, you know, he was out all night, many nights, doing house calls. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan said that that was really what informed his own commitment to social justice and to helping people,
mm-hmm.
seeing his father on a daily, nightly basis going out and doing that.
Right.
Now, it sounds like his mother maybe wasn't quite on the same page. How did she react to Jonathan going to help with the civil rights movement?
She had certainly started to change her stance by that time. I think she was certainly worried about Jonathan, but she'd seen what he'd been doing over a number of years in working in Providence and in Boston as part of his seminary work. So I think she was proud of him, but certainly worried about him. And then after his death, she really became an activist as well.
She definitely did.
I have
a lot of admiration for Connie Daniels, going from a socialite wearing pearls and cashmere sweaters to losing her husband he was in his 50s, to losing her only son at the age of 26, mm-hmm. and really not having any finances to continue, going back to school, becoming a French teacher, and really when Jonathan was killed and the trial of his killer ended up, his killer, Tom Coleman, was acquitted by an all-male, all-white jury. Connie Daniels, of course, was not only devastated by the death of her son, by that result, but she chose to turn her grief into activism. And together with the group of black residents of Lowndes County, Connie sued the Lowndes County judicial system for illegal jury practices. And they won that civil lawsuit. So within a year of Jonathan's death, blacks and women of all races were on juries in Alabama, and other states in the South followed suit. It's actually a famous case called White v. Crook that attorneys in college and university study, and that's because of Jonathan Daniels.
Wow.
What an amazing tribute to her son for her to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very brave. And
yeah.
She was more and more outspoken after his death, speaking on his behalf and finding her own form of activism right until she died in her mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, is there, are you work? Someone should write a book about her.
Yeah, she was an incredible woman in her transformation, absolutely.
Now,
I wanted to read, if I will, I always found it incredibly fascinating, the juxtaposition between Jonathan's life as a seminary student in Cambridge, Boston, and what was happening in Selma, just at the precipice of a Bloody Sunday. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to read that segment, and I think it really is a jarring contrast and a call to arms that Jonathan accepted.
Of course. This is Sandra Neal Wallace reading from Blood Brothers.
The number of days left in his life, because this is Bloody Sunday, and it's 167 days left.
Wow.
The only things Selma, Alabama, and Boston had in common on the Sunday afternoon of March 7th, 1965, were bone-chilling temperatures. As Jonathan stepped off the train from Providence, Rhode Island, and braced for the cold walk to his newly painted dorm room in Boston, 25-year-old civil rights leader John Lewis faced the biting Selma wind head-on. The same age as Jonathan Daniels, Lewis also dreamed of becoming a minister. As a child, Lewis preached to the chickens on his family's Alabama farm, while Jonathan gave sermons in the skull and bone space below his New Hampshire home. Now Lewis led a line of 600 black protesters headed across the Alabama River to see Governor George Wallace. They were angry that a white state trooper had killed Jimmy Lee Jackson, an unarmed black man, at a peaceful voting rights march and got away with it. They were determined to walk 54 miles to the state capitol in Montgomery to protest police brutality and demand equal voting rights. Stuffed in their coat pockets were toothbrushes in case they were arrested. Lewis expected that he'd be jailed longer, since he was chairman of the civil rights group Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, nicknamed SNCC. They'd been working in Selma to ensure voting rights. He'd tossed an apple and an orange into his knapsack. But no one expected such frigid temperatures or what waited for them on the other side of the river. Clutching woolen scarves, they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, walking silently two by two. The men marched at the front and the back of the line to protect the women and children who held hands in the middle. But as they reached the crest of the bridge over the rushing Alabama River, John Lewis spotted a sea of blue uniforms. 150 Alabama state troopers stood shoulder to shoulder, blocking the other side. Dallas County Sheriff Jim Clark waited with his nightstick too, a weapon well known to the marchers. Sheriff Clark's posse of special deputies rode on horseback, carrying bullwhips and barely keeping their mounts from charging. John Lewis and the group kept walking. Then came the order. "This demonstration will not continue," an officer shouted into a bullhorn. "I will give you 2 minutes to leave." John Lewis needed to act swiftly. "Can you swim?" a marcher asked him. It was a long way down to the river. "No," Lewis replied. Suddenly, he knew what to tell the marchers. Huddled in a TV room in Boston, Jonathan was in a heated discussion about the Vietnam War, where the United States backed South Vietnam in its battles against North Vietnam's communist regime. Though he wouldn't be drafted because of his asthma, Jonathan made it clear that he'd be willing to go to jail instead of to war. He was still angry about President Johnson's announcement earlier in the week. Johnson had given the go-ahead to bomb North Vietnam. The first American combat troops were on their way. Jonathan didn't pay much attention to the television program about Nazis blaring in the background until a breaking news story interrupted the TV show. Expecting it to be about Vietnam, someone cranked up the volume, but the news footage was from Selma, Alabama. John Lewis had turned around and told the marchers to kneel down and pray, but he was too late. Troopers had strapped on their gas masks, raised their weapons, and stormed into the crowd. Jonathan watched in horror as the peaceful marchers who were protesting police brutality became the victims of it. A state trooper clubbed Lewis in the head, and he crumpled to the ground. The posse on horseback whipped women and children, blinded by clouds of noxious tear gas. But who could outrun a charging stallion? "The sight of them rolling over us like human tanks was something that had never been seen before," John Lewis recalled. Americans watching on TV were outraged and ashamed. They anticipated war footage from Vietnam half a world away, not bloody battle scenes within their own country. "I don't understand how President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam," Lewis said before being rushed to the hospital with a fractured skull, "and cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people whose only desire is to register to vote." The attack became known as Bloody Sunday. Nearby in a Selma hotel room, Reverend John Morris was making phone calls after listening helplessly to the police beatings on a radio. Morris, who would soon become Jonathan Daniels' mentor, had founded the Episcopal Society for Cultural and Racial Unity to fight segregation and to pressure the Episcopal Church to embrace change. The white Georgia native telephoned his close friend, Martin Luther King, in Atlanta, urging him to lead a march from Selma to Montgomery on Tuesday, this time with the support of sympathetic whites from across the country. Morris knew that King's presence was essential to bring more attention to what the marchers strived to achieve. King had been in Selma several times that year to lead voting rights marches, and he'd been arrested and spent time in jail. Morris was convinced from his phone calls that he could round up 100 white clergy for a minister's march. He helped King compose a telegram. believing that ending racism was the responsibility of all religious leaders, Moore suggested that King call on clergy of the nation to help bear the burden. King agreed, and that night he wired an urgent telegram to churches and seminaries, including EDS, where Jonathan attended. Using Morris's suggestion, King described the brutality against the marchers and insisted that Selma residents would continue to stand for justice. But he also asked that others join them and bear the burden, particularly members of the clergy. But what exactly did King mean by bearing the burden? John Lewis knew. He wanted to see, Lewis explained, whether the state troopers, Sheriff Clark, and the local police would use the same force and degree of brutality against white citizens from the North as they had against poor white black folks. For Jonathan, the talk of Vietnam was over. His focus was now on freedom at home and the black Americans who didn't have it.
Thank you, Sandra. This is
the same John Lewis, of course, who's now Congressman John Lewis,
right,
who served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Georgia for many decades.
And were you able to interview him for your book?
We did not interview John Lewis. He's been on the record a great deal speaking about those moments. So we spent our energy and resources on interviewing people who really had not been interviewed much before. Those former teenagers from Selma and people in Keene and people who weren't on the record yet.
When I was choosing that excerpt to read, Richard reminded me that, do you realize how much research went into that excerpt? Because we have an editor who insists on having source notes for every single so mm-hmm. I think there were probably 25 to 30 sources that were used for that excerpt, from diaries, letters, journals, court documents. So there's obviously newspaper articles as well from the New York Times.
Wow.
You know, what's the saddest thing to me is that the number of people who do not vote in elections. And they
Well, that's something we're hoping that this book will help emphasize. You know, here in Keene, just last night, there were several dozen large banners that went up all over downtown Keene, which is a college town of about 30,000 people, lovely New England setting. And they're all of the posters have Jonathan Daniels' picture on it and a quote from kids saying, you know, Jonathan died so we could vote. Let's not let him down. That sort of sentiment is all over town here in
Keene. Oh, wow. How has your book been received there in Keene?
It's been very well received nationally and also in Keene. I think what people are grateful, especially people who know Jonathan, is that we were able to really firm up timelines about his life and to determine that his activism started much earlier than previously known from the first two phases of research on Jonathan Daniels, which occurred in the 1960s and then in the 1990s. There was a documentary done on Jonathan Daniels. So we really are the third prong of research from the 21st century. And to be able to interview teenagers who worked with Jonathan, to work with diaries and never-before-seen primary documents was really key for us. And we were able to determine through facial forensics even that Jonathan was present at the March on Washington in 1963. And we were also able to confirm with VMI that he marched in President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. So he heard iconic speeches from I Have a Dream to Ask Not What Your Country Can Do for You. Yeah. And of course, we know that he marched from Selma to Montgomery. So he was involved in pivotal civil rights demonstrations that ended up really resulting in change. And I think his life is an example of blacks and whites working together to fight an injustice nonviolently and creating tremendous change. If you think about what happened after the March on Washington, the Civil Rights Act was passed, and what happened after the March from Selma to Montgomery, the Voting Rights Act was passed. Mm. So interracial demonstrations and collaborations work and would continue to work. And as a matter of fact, Ruby Sales talks a lot about that after she's read the book. She's been very, very impressed how the book can be a template for Americans today on how they can work together to create change and injustices.
You know, there's an organization...
Very prolific writer throughout his life. So we had just incredible access at Keene State College, in the local historical society here, and in private collections that we were able to have access to letters that Jonathan wrote throughout his life, letters that Jonathan received throughout his life, writings that he had done for the high school newspaper, writings he had done while he was at VMI, diaries that other people had kept. So we had real tremendous access to first-hand material that much of it had never been looked at before.
Well, you're keeping history alive, and there's an organization started here in Fairfield by Patty Miller, who participated. She was in, I think she was from Iowa, and she participated in Freedom Summer, which I believe was the summer before Jonathan Daniels went. Right. And she started this foundation to make sure that those stories that don't die, that people know keeping history alive is important. Because
it is, you know, history is power, and history creates change. And when we forget our history, we tend to repeat our transgressions. So history is just an incredible template for people of all ages to find out what have people done in similar situations, and what do we want to perpetuate, and what do we want to make sure we don't repeat. And just to elaborate on keeping this history alive, it's so important to interview people in the civil rights movement who aren't going to be around much longer. And because of this book, we've been able to work on other stories and create oral histories of other incredible stories that we were able to uncover while we were doing research on this biography.
I was going to ask you about that, if you had uncovered other stories that you wanted to delve into. Now, Sandra, your background was as a sports announcer, sports journalist. Is that, I mean, and now you're basically writing a book of history. You've become a historian. What skills
before
did you...
Before I was a sports announcer, I was a news anchor and hard news reporter for more than a decade. So that really is my prime. Yeah, I went to journalism.
Okay. So I'm wondering how you became a historian.
Right. Yeah, and a historian activist.
Right.
Yes, if you will, too. So it was interesting. After I had done hard news for so many years and enjoyed sports, I really felt that I needed to change, and I got involved in writing creative writing and fiction, albeit realistic fiction. And then after many years of that, a funny thing happened. I craved interviewing and digging stories. And when we found out about Jonathan, we knew that would be a terrific story for us to uncover and unearth and see if we could put our investigative journalism hats together and find people to interview about Jonathan and to really uncover, using science, whether Jonathan indeed was on the march, you know, on Washington, and to just use all the tools that we could as journalists to uncover the stories about Jonathan Daniels.
So you've both worked then as fiction writers as well as journalists. Is that true?
Pretty much, yeah. I was a newspaper reporter and primarily a sports writer, and then I was an editor at Highlights for Children magazine for many years. I wanted to mention that even with Sandra's fiction, each of her novels has a strong social justice underpinning to it. So this is not a new direction for her at all.
Now, what made you decide to work together on a book?
Well, we had done one book previously. Well, we're both writers. We've been, you know, we spend all of our day and well into the night, lots of the time, writing fiction, which was something, you know, we obviously did separately. Writing a book of, you know, where you make things up.
Yeah, it's a little harder to co-write.
Yeah. Well, I think we may be able to do that with fiction in the future. But an editor, Carolyn Yoder, who's the editor of this book and our prior book, had been kind of prodding us for a few years to write some nonfiction, book-length nonfiction. And we said, well, that's something we probably could do together, having both, you know, research and journalism backgrounds. So our first book was about Babe Didrikson Zaharias, who was the great female athlete of the previous century, the 1932 Olympic hero. And so that was our first book together, and we immediately started looking for another project. We had moved to Keene, New Hampshire by then and started hearing, you know, bits and pieces about Jonathan Daniels, and it didn't take long for us to realize that that was what we wanted to pursue next.
It did take us a while to get into a rhythm, and a lot of people ask us, you know, do you have arguments and fights, or do you have to, you know, kind of negotiate, you know, what stays in or what stays out? And really what we found what works for us is both of us read the all the research material, no matter how cumbersome that may seem. And then naturally what we do is we decide the narrative voice. And we're pretty firm on that. And then naturally we seem to gravitate towards different areas of a person's life in a biography. And then we come together and edit each other's work to make sure that the voice is distinct and continues, and that person never gets lost in the narrative. And, of course, we have our editor from Calkins Creek who is on board with that as well. And it's really worked, and we're excited to continue to do more biographies with social justice themes.
And what about the interviews? Do you do them together, too?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we'll prepare, you know, an outline in advance for what we want to gain from an interview, and maybe decide who might ask which question. But the thing with an interview, there's always a great deal of follow-up, or it'll go in a different direction than you anticipate. Having two of us at work on an interview like that is helpful in that if I forget something, she'll remember it, and vice versa.
Do you record interviews or just take notes during them?
We record and take notes. So Usually one person is the primary interviewer and the other one is the note taker.
And
I'm dreading the day when I still have my journalist tape recorder. I think I have a dozen Sony tapes left. They're discontinued, so I guess I'll have to do the recording by phone or Skype. Mm-hmm. But I really, really love the one-on-one interviews wherever possible.
Wow. And with all the other research that you do, how do you organize it? How do you, like, call out the pieces that you think you might want to use so that you'll be able to find them when you go to write that section?
Oh, you know, we'll have binders that are tagged, and we'll put things in manila folders that kind of go together. But we'll spend time, you know, searching for something. We know it's there somewhere, but we've learned to be pretty organized about those sorts of things.
Yeah, we do chapter and chapter. I actually have color coding in terms of what could potentially be a quote and what will be a narration and where to find it. So what was interesting about this and totally new to me is I had never done photo research before for a book at this depth level, where it's basically 6 months full-time just photo research. And that was a huge learning curve for me to be in charge of photo research. And we culled that from so many different areas, from private collections to the Library of Congress to obviously Jonathan's own photos to wire services, and also the iconic civil rights photographers of the day who were so enthusiastic of being in a book about Jonathan Daniels, and they knew who Jonathan Daniels was.
Were there any issues with getting permissions to use any photos?
There were. Yeah. There were. We had a challenge with the, actually a telegram with the King Center. They're very strict with photo credit. But for the most part, it was just a matter of making, you know, 300 phone calls and making sure that we, courtesy lines were, you know, the high-resolution photos that we needed for graphics. So that was a big learning curve, knowing what the resolutions were needed for for publishing, and making sure that we could afford the photographs as well. And like I said, we were very fortunate that the iconic photographers from Spider Martin to Bob Adelman and Danny Leon really worked with us to make sure that we could get their photos in our book about Jonathan.
One photo that we were absolutely certain we wanted to have on the cover was the photo at the top where you have a line of individuals on the left, black and white protesters, most of them young, standing face-to-face and toe-to-toe with a line of troopers and sheriff's deputies in Selma, Alabama, a couple of days after Bloody Sunday. And that photo was taken by Bob Adelman in 1965, and when we saw it, we said, that looks like it could have been taken in Ferguson yesterday. It looks like it could have been taken in Baltimore or St. Paul or Charlotte, anywhere where these kinds of demonstrations and tense moments are happening now. So that, to us, that having that photo on the cover of the book would really underscore the timeliness of this book.
What I'm wondering is how is it that you happen to go to that town where he grew up?
Well, we raised two boys in Pennsylvania, and when the second one was getting close to finishing college, as freelance writers, we can go, you know, we can be anywhere pretty much these days.
Mm-hmm.
We work from our home. We'd vacationed in New England a lot. Sanders from Canada. We knew that this was a region of the country that we really loved, and we said, we can go anywhere. Let's find a great New England college town that's walkable and beautiful and you know, just fits our likes and our needs. And so we kept coming back to Keene, New Hampshire, and eventually we moved here.
Where in Pennsylvania did you live?
We were in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, which is in the northeast corner of the state. And we were there because I was running the editorial department of Highlights for Children magazine, which is headquartered there. The editorial office is headquartered there, and the business offices are in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, my dad's family has been in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, for like 13 generations. So that's where I spent part of my childhood. And, of course, Mom was there, too.
Our older son went to school in that area, Berg University.
Well, we're just about out of time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know.
This has been a great interview, and you both, you put a great deal of yourselves into this book.
And I can see why it took 3 years. I mean, there's a lot of material here, and it's a story that everyone should know.
Yes.
Any possibilities?
Pretty proud of Blood Brother. I've done several dozen books, and this is certainly the one I'm the most proud of.
Wow. And Sandra, would you say the same?
I definitely would. And especially, I can't think of a more gratifying way to utilize investigative journalism than to write books with social justice themes that can impact the world today and, you know, inspire young people, and that's really important. You know, one of the great things about writing stories like this is that we can provide windows for readers to meet people who don't necessarily look like them and to see them in a human and personal way. And, you know, maybe that reader or that reader's children will become the policymakers or the law enforcement officers of the future who build bridges instead of barriers. And that's the feedback that we're getting from people that read this book. They didn't know someone like Jonathan Daniels did what he did and formed an alliance with other Americans, all races working together to fight an injustice and having success.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And Mom, do you have some closing words in our last few seconds?
I do. This is a quote from Ernest Hemingway. As you get older, it's more difficult to have heroes, but it's just as necessary.
And thank you so much for being with us today on Writers' Voices, and see you next week.